Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Eleanor Parker about her book entitled Dragon Lords, The History and Legends of Viking England. Eleanor, welcome to New Books Network.
Hi.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
So I'm a medievalist, obviously. I teach Old and Middle English literature at the University of Oxford. And as we will discuss, I'm sure my special interest is in the Vikings in England.
I thought that it was an especially interesting subject given, you know, some of the issues that we have with accessing the Vikings. I'm no specialist in medieval history, but I do know that so much of the history of the Vikings and their history in England is difficult to access because at that time the Vikings themselves didn't write. And yet you took on a topic that, you know, requires a lot of, you know, analysis and digging. What was it that led you to write this book?
Well, that was one of the things that interested me about it, actually, that you say that the Vikings kind of didn't write their own story until quite a bit after the Viking Age, really. So what the book is mostly about is how other people perceived the Vikings, but also how far we can see what you might call Viking perspectives coming across in English sources. And I was just really interested in that question of, can we actually work out what the Vikings or the descendants of the Vikings thought about their activities in England?
I was wondering if you could start us off by talking a little bit about that history of the Viking interaction with England. I mean, what sort of period of time are we talking about, and what was their level of engagement with the English population? Because as you explain in the book, that has a lot to do with how they're viewed in the English literary sources.
Yeah, so one important thing to say is that it's quite a long period we're talking about, starting in the 8th century and then going up right to the 11th century. So, you know, several centuries of Anglo-Saxon history. And what I particularly look at in the book is the fact that there's lots of different types of Viking activity in England. So there's kind of raiding, which I guess most people associate with the Vikings. But it's also important that in particularly northern and eastern England, the Vikings settled down and interacted with the local population and, you know, really made England their home and kind of forged a mixed Anglo-Scandinavian society in those regions. So you do get Viking armies, you know, raiding and killing and all that kind of stuff that the classic Viking stuff, but also trading, of course, between England and Scandinavia, and then this pattern of settlement in the 9th century, which is a really important factor in the history of those regions of England.
And yet you also have this point at which there is this disruption in the 11th century, after which the Vikings are no longer have quite that same control over the population that they had in the centuries in which they were so dominant.
Yeah, that's right. So in the Anglo-Saxon period, England was very kind of oriented towards Scandinavia in lots of ways. I mean, it had relationships with other European countries as well, of course, you know, Normandy and so on. But it was very much looking to the north, and after the Norman conquest, that really shifted to a substantial degree, and kind of England was never quite as Scandinavian ever again.
Well, I make the point because I was thinking as I was reading your book about how the how so many of the stories you describe their development, how that so much of it occurs in the that we can recover in the post Anglo-Saxon period, you know, during the Normans and the Plantagenets and so forth, and how, you know, at that point maybe the Vikings don't have quite as much of a say in terms of how they appear in the writings of the people of England.
Yeah, that's right. So by that point, you're very much looking at kind of how people are perceiving or remembering or looking back on that history. And, you know, the actual events of the Viking Age are now very distant by that point. And so they very much get turned into legend and story. And it really kind of isn't history any longer, but an interpretation of history.
I was wondering if you could maybe explain to us, what are some of the source materials that we're talking about here? What are these English writings? What are some of these English writings in which the Vikings are featured or mentioned in a way that influences our understanding of them?
So it's a kind of a range of sources, really. You've got so some chronicles and histories, and kind of obviously you'd expect to find stories there. Also saints' lives, because there are a number of important popular English saints who were killed by the Vikings or interacted with the Vikings. So that's also an important source. And then particularly in the later medieval period, romance. So stories which are like versions of history, but very much turned into narrative and legend, not kind of aiming to be a strict historical narrative. And all of those kinds of different sources sort of feed into each other in the medieval period. There's not like a clear dividing line between any of those genres of literature.
Is there any one or two of them which stand out in particular as having informed your analysis or that have really stood out in terms of shaping our understanding of the Vikings?
I think what's really interesting is what emerges when you consider them all together, actually. So often these texts have been studied kind of individually, like one particular romance, which is about a Viking hero, like the story of Havelok, is kind of taken to be an unusual story. Like, why is it about a Viking hero? But actually, if you consider it in the context of all of these other types of sources, you can see kind of common interests and common features. And they're sometimes asking the same questions about why were the Vikings here? Why did they come to England? What did they do here? What was their effect on England?
So when you were writing the your book, how were you basically then taking the stories collectively and drawing out the tales? Or were you focusing upon one tale and then seeing where it might have appeared elsewhere in different forms?
Well, you can kind of divide. There are certain heroes who appear in a number of different sources, so you can kind of compare how a certain story is told by different writers or in different periods or different places in England. And then you can kind of take a global view of all of those stories. And often, even if they're about different heroes or slightly different stories, they do still take a sort of similar interest in the Vikings. So you get certain themes kind of recurring again and again, like the real desire that English writers had to make the Vikings story a personal one. Like, they must have come because there was someone's death they were trying to avenge or something like that. That's a feature that comes up again and again in lots of different types of stories, which is kind of interesting.
It's funny you mentioned that, because I was thinking about how much that plays a role some of the stories of the first character you feature in your book, which is Ragnar Lothbrok. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Lothbrok, yeah.
And how you point out how that's, you know, something that is mentioned as a motivation in some of the events undertaken by his sons. I was wondering if you could perhaps tell us a bit about the character and how and what we understand about him, and then maybe some of the representations of both him and his sons in the various forms of English literature that you've discussed.
In the English tradition, Lothbrok is quite a different character from what he is in Scandinavian literature. So in Scandinavian literature, he's very much a great Viking warrior, leader, dragon fighter, all of that. In England, Lothbrok is just this, usually just this kind of fairly harmless Viking who kind of ends up in England, sometimes just by accident in some of the stories, and is sort of becomes connected with the King of East Anglia, whose name is Edmund, who was a real historical figure who was actually killed by the Vikings. And so these stories about Lothbrok are sort of reinterpreting Edmund's death in one of the most common versions of the story. He's kind of friends with Lothbrok. Lothbrok is at his court and Lothbrok gets murdered. He's completely innocent. But when his sons find out that he's been murdered, they come and get revenge and they blame Edmund, even though it's not really Edmund's fault either. So this is clearly a story which is sort of developing from the actual historical event of Edmund's death in 869. And yet is sort of giving Lothbrok a role in the story and then giving his sons this fairly kind of sympathetic motive of they've come to England to kill Edmund, which is kind of a horrible thing to do, but they're doing it to avenge their father. So that sort of makes them sympathetic.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And yet, as you explain, it's not necessarily a consistent story about Lothbrok and his sons that you see throughout all the various mentions of him in medieval literature, that there are variations and twists upon it. What's going on there?
Well, I think it's just when you see variations of that kind, it's evidence that the story is being told. It's being shared maybe in oral tradition as well as in written sources. And in this case, it seems likely that the first stories about Ragnar and his sons were sort of told in England and then maybe went to Scandinavia, to Denmark, and they're different in Denmark and Norway and Iceland. And then in different parts of England, they have different versions of the story. So it's just evidence of a story that's in wide circulation, probably.
Okay. I'd like to move on to the next figure you feature, and that's, again, if I apologize, if I mispronounce, is it Siward?
Seward.
And how you here you have a character for whom, as you explain, we have more historical information about, so we can do more of a comparison with the history that we know in terms of understanding the elements of his tale that are common and the other elements of his tale that may be more changed or adapted. But what's going on with Seward?
Yeah, so again, in this case, you've got someone who was a real historical figure, in this case, in the 11th century. He was a Scandinavian earl in the time of King Canute, and he was Earl of Northumbria, which was a very large and important kingdom, earldom in England. And sometime after his death in the 11th century, maybe the 12th or 13th century, you get a story being told about him, which is clearly unhistorical. So, for instance, it says he's descended from a bear. So obviously, not to tell that. And also has other stories about him fighting dragons and having this kind of prophetic encounter with someone who may or may not be Odin, kind of telling him how to go and make his fortune in London and all that kind of thing. So that's clearly a legendary story. And it's made up of elements which sort of belong to Anglo-Scandinavian traditions and narrative legends. But clearly somebody was interested in telling this story about Siward and giving him this kind of great saga of his own almost.
And that's one of the things I found so fascinating in reading your book, which was this idea that it was what you're getting at is not just these Vikings and how they're being perceived and how those interpretations are changing, but also the flip side of it, which is that you have these English authors who are seeking to engage with this element of their past, even though as time goes along, it become and we start the Normans come in and England has that orientation more towards the more southerly part of the continent, about how it's becoming an increasingly alien part of their past.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of makes it more fertile ground for reimagining, I suppose. The further it gets back into the distant past, the more you can play around with it and turn it into a story that provides something for a contemporary audience.
Hmm. Well, it's also interesting how you don't just address stories centered around these characters. You also talk about stories of Englishmen from the period that are in which the Vikings or the Danes are featured individuals with it. And here I'm thinking of your chapter on Guy of Wardwick. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about him and the representation of the Danes in the story and what that reveals.
Yeah, so that's an interesting example, because in that case, Guy or Guy of Warwick is our hero. So he's the one we're supposed to be sympathizing with, and he's fighting against the Vikings. The Vikings are invading England. And that's not an uncommon kind of pattern, as you might be able to imagine in medieval histories, that, you know, the Vikings are coming to invade and some English army has to stand up against them and whatever. But what's unusual about the Guy of Warwick story is that the Danes in that case are sort of presented as having quite a good reason for coming to England and quite a good case for claiming they have some right to rule in England. And so that's taken kind of seriously within the context of the romance. It's not like they're not just, you know, Vikings coming to raid and steal stuff and you have to, you know, get rid of them because they're a sort of invading plague. In Guy of Warwick, they're sort of treated like they have some right to make this claim, but our hero Guy is going to defeat them and that will sort of solve the problem. But it's very much treated as a kind of political dispute between two kind of fairly not equally entitled parties, but two interested parties who have some right to rule England.
Something I thought was especially interesting, because I was thinking as a basis of comparison how you might see in modern day fiction the representation of the villain or the antagonist as being a figure who is, has no honorable motive or reasonable motive. They're just bad. And here it seems they take the Vikings very maturely, and they give them representations that seem respectable. Was there any effort to tie it to any sort of historical evidence, or to what degree did these sometimes were they made out of whole cloth?
I think very often they're quite a long way away from the historical sources, or rather from what really happened. But what's quite interesting is, I guess these stories do reflect that England's history with the Vikings is very complex. It isn't a straightforward story of good and bad. Some people are happy to tell it that way, but a lot of other writers seem to recognise that actually this is a history which sometimes is violent, but often is also about peaceful settlement and coexistence and integration and so on as well. It is a complex story, and some writers are prepared to acknowledge that complexity, I think.
I'd like to turn our attention now to the story of Havelok, which you've already mentioned in passing. What does it have to say about the Danes and their presence, and how are they represented in the story?
So Havelok is an example of a story where... So it's an incredibly popular story, as far as we can tell, especially in Lincolnshire, and in the East Midlands in the Middle Ages. And it's very hard to know what the historical basis of that story is, or if Havelok is based on a real person or anything like that. But clearly the story was meaningful, whether or not it had any historical basis. And this is the story. Havelok is a Danish prince who ends up, for whatever reason, according to different versions of the story, kind of exiled in England, growing up in England, growing up in poverty, actually, in Grimsby, which is in northern Lincolnshire. And when he grows up, he manages to regain his kingdom and marry an English princess, and so kind of unite England and Denmark in one country and live to be a great good king. So it's a nice example of how people were thinking about a very positive representation of a Viking king. You know, Havelok is this sort of saintly like hero, really. He's good with children and he's nice to everybody, and you know, not at all your typical image of the Vikings.
It's interesting how saintly he's portrayed in that, because it gets to this, you know, what you conclude your book with, which is this examination of the Vikings' cultural legacy, their presence in the English memory. Throughout your book, you analyze these particular instances, and you talk about various changes and alterations that take place, differences between the depictions that take place over chronicles stretching over hundreds of years. What do they all say together about the Vikings and their legacy for England in the Middle Ages and perhaps even down to today?
Well, they really say, I think what they collectively kind of say is that the Vikings are an important part of the history of England, not just because, you know, as I was saying, not just because of they raided, but because they settled in northern and eastern England. And they really did leave a lasting cultural legacy, particularly in those regions. And it's often from those parts of England that the stories that I'm looking at originate. So there's a real sense in which they are an important, a formative part of those particular regions of England, and something that sets them apart and makes them distinctive. And actually, you can really see that in even northern culture today. Even if you just look at a map of place names in England, you can see a very clear divide between Scandinavian place names in the north and Anglo-Saxon, mostly, place names in the south. It's definitely still a cultural divide that you can see in England.
Is that also reflected in the representation as well? This is not a past that they are ashamed of. They recognize that this is a part of who they are, and so therefore they treat it with honor as well?
Yeah, definitely. I think, in my view, you can see that in the medieval sources, that there's, you know, a clear sense in which some of these people are really proud of having Viking ancestors. Like, you know, the Vikings came to Lincolnshire, for instance, and we're proud of that. And then certainly today there are parts of England which are really proud of their Viking heritage. You know, if you go to York, you will find they are very proud to say they're a Viking city. And so it's definitely felt to be something that's still important.
Well, we've taken up a good chunk of your time. I was wondering if you could tell us, though, what you're working on now.
Well, I'm working now on a book about people who grew up in the shadow of the Norman Conquest. So children, people who were children at the time of the conquest and then had to live their adult lives in the shadow of that life-changing event.
It's fascinating. Is it going to be primarily a literary study, or are you going to be incorporating social history as well?
It's a bit of both.
Oh, wow. Sounds like a fascinating book. I hope we can have you back on the New Books Network to talk about it when it's done.
Thank you.
Eleanor Parker, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thanks very much.